Tonight on Arena, Niamh Ní Maolaodhain on modern day sainthood and Justin Knox on his travels around the past slave cities of Europe. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena or watch live on rte.ie/arena. Our first item has a strong connection with events in Rome as Pope Francis lies in state in St. Peter's Basilica. Until the Pope's death on Monday, this weekend was to mark the canonisation of the first millennial saint, Carlos Acutis. However, the canonisation has now been postponed. Carlo Acutis is one of the inspirations for the debut novel of Niamh Ní Maolaodhain, Ordinary Saints. It is the story of Jay, a young gay woman living in London who's estranged from her deeply religious parents and haunted by her older brother Ferdia's sudden death. And when she hears that a campaign is afoot to make Ferdia a saint, Jay is forced to confront the ghosts of her past. And I'm delighted to say Niamh Ní Maolaodhain joins me now. Niamh, you're very welcome to Arena. Your novel raises some fascinating questions about the old and new Irelands. And one of your inspirations, as I say, was the story of Carlo Acutis, who was due to be canonised in Rome this coming weekend. What was it about his life that inspired Ordinary Saints?
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me. So I first encountered Carlo's story back in 2020 when he was beatified. And I just, like lots of people, I didn't know that this was still something that the Catholic Church was doing. And it really just, that story immediately kind of struck me like a bolt of lightning, in that Carlo was only 2 years younger than me. He was almost exactly the same age as my younger sister. And at the time, his body was lying in state. It still is. It's on display in Assisi. And just, I think, seeing someone kind of my own age who clearly had a life not a million miles from, you know, that of myself or my friends was just really, really striking to me. And I kind of had a bit of a, like I say, a lightning bolt moment where I could see the kind of shape of this story in front of me.
Yes, because we usually think that it takes maybe hundreds of years for a saint to be canonized. You don't think that that's going to happen in the lifetime of siblings.
Exactly so, yeah. And I think, and that typically would be the case. I mean, Carlo's kind of progress through this canonization process has been incredibly fast. And I think that speaks to the fact that the church is looking for these kind of young figureheads who can maybe inspire and even arguably recruit younger people to the church. And yeah, I think that something that really struck me about his story is that he has two younger siblings who were born after the time that he died. And that, to me, I just thought, what on earth must this be like for these children to grow up with this brother they never knew, but whose life is everywhere, whose story and image is everywhere. And ultimately, you know, I've changed a lot of the detail in the way that I've written the novel, but that kind of fundamental question about what this must be like for a sibling. And on top of this, obviously devastating loss. You know, Carlo died of leukemia when he was 15, which is, you know, a terrible thing for any family to go through. And then to have this kind of slightly mind-bending, you know, ancient process going on alongside that grief, I thought must be really, really strange for families.
Now, in your book, Ordinary Saints, we have Jacinta, or as she chooses to be called in as she grows up, Jay. And then she has her brother who died tragically at a young age. He was in the priesthood and he'd been earmarked, you know, as a devout child all his life. And now he's earmarked for canonization. What was it about her brother, Ferdia, that made him so saint-like?
Well, this is one of the questions at the centre of the novel, because by the time the main action of the novel starts, Ferdia is long dead. And so we only ever kind of see him through other people's eyes. But as a young child, his mother would bring him to mass, you know, nearly every day when he was a baby. And he kind of started, they lived in Maynooth, and he would kind of talk to all the different saints in the college chapel there in Maynooth. And then as he got older, he would try and go to mass every day. He would go and visit people who were sick and kind of pray with them. And, you know, he would have this kind of quite profound impact on people. And then as he kind of got into his teens, he decided that he did want to enter the priesthood, and he ultimately went to study at the Irish College in Rome, and that was where he was living at the time that he died. But I will say there's always a bit of a question mark in the novel, where Ferdia is a bit difficult to know. It's a bit difficult to know exactly how his memory is being used by different people, and that could be that the church wants to view him a certain way, his parents remember him another way. And then to Jay, you know, he was her big brother and she loved him. And she's kind of struggling with the fact that she feels his memory is getting taken away from her.
Now, not unusually, but maybe it seems a little unusual in the modern day, both parents are very devout Catholics. And this does have an influence on the house, on both Jay and her brother Ferdia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And for Ferdia, it's kind of, he's aligned with the family's kind of the family's religious belief. He kind of entirely fits in with that. And, you know, their mother particularly, like, she for a time was in a convent. She was a postulant, and then she ultimately left and pursued a different kind of life instead. But she's almost living that vision of life that she didn't have. She's almost living that through Ferdia. And so, you know, that's as a family unit, the mother, father and Ferdia all kind of fit together. But then Jay kind of sticks out. She's not a part of that. She is religious as a child, but not in the same kind of intense way that Ferdia is. And then, you know, around the time of his death, as she's getting older, she starts to realize her queer identity. And she starts to, that becomes an increasingly large part of her life, and that feels incompatible with the family's religion. And kind of with all of that in the mix, with kind of the grief for Ferdia, but also her sexuality and her kind of loss of faith, she drifts away from the family, and she really struggles with this feeling of always being on the outside, this feeling that she isn't as good as Ferdia was, that the parents don't love her as much as they did Ferdia. And that's really when this novel begins. It's more than a decade after his death, but all of those feelings are still really, really raw for Jay.
Now, like many great Irish novels, the book does veer into the life of the saints. I was thinking of Angela's Ashes and many other great books that do bring us into the lives of the saint. And Maria Goretti is a very interesting saint. I had no idea that, again, her canonization was fairly fast-tracked, so that there was something unusual about the person who caused her to be a saint by the saint he tried to inflict on her. Can you tell us a little bit about her and what was unusual about her canonization?
Yes, absolutely. So I, like you say, there's the novel kind of tells the stories briefly of lots of different saints, particularly contemporary saints, so people from the last century or so. And Maria Goretti was an 11-year-old child. And she was in her home in Italy, and her next door neighbor tried to sexually assault her, and she resisted, and he killed her. She was murdered, and then immediately this kind of interest started to grow up around her, and there was a movement to canonize her. She was what's called a virgin martyr, which is a specific category of saint, which is women who died in defense of their chastity. But again, like her, you know, her body is on public display. And also very, to me, very, very disturbingly, the man who killed her became part of the story, and that when he was in prison, he had a conversion to the faith. He became very religious, and he developed a devotion to her memory and to her sainthood. And he was actually at her ceremony of canonization. And that story, when I heard it, really, really troubled me and raised some huge questions about this process.
Yes, I didn't realise that kicker of the story. Another thing that you talk about, then we get into the Vatican making, is it the Vatican? Well, whoever deals with the canonisation, they get involved and start contacting the family. First of all, the parents think Ferdia is due to be made a saint, and then they elicit the interest of the Vatican and they come visiting. And what comes out is that the body of the person who is likely to become a saint, or they want him to become a saint, becomes kind of the property, that the body itself is important. And this relates back to Jay's original name, which was Jacinta, which was one of the children of Fatima. Can you get into the whole exhumation and this kind of glorification of the body of saints?
Yes, absolutely. So this, again, this is something that I find very troubling and strange, even though it's something that almost gets taken for granted. And the way lots of people will have come across this is that, particularly if you're on holiday in Rome, maybe you might go to St. Peter's and there's lots of bodies of the popes on display, or in churches you'll mm-hmm. see the bodies of saints. In order for a person to be canonized, their body has to be exhumed. It has to be examined to verify who they are, to kind of evaluate the state of the body, because a body not decomposing is seen as a potential sign of saintliness. And then ultimately bodies will be interred in an altar if someone becomes a saint. But I think, you know, if whatever about if it's adults, to me, if it's children that this is happening to, that raises for me some pretty big ethical questions.
Yes, because this happened to one of the children of Fatima, that she was exhumed twice.
Yes, she was. And the first time the body hadn't particularly decomposed, but then the second time it had. And there's some very disturbing images that are online of kind of these groups of people kind of gathering to look at this child's body. And I think that now, in the modern day, I think it's done with a lot more sensitivity. But the kind of fundamentals are still there, that the body will be exhumed, that, you know, it will be examined, you know, chunks of it will be kind of taken out and sent around the world as relics. And I think that's probably something a lot of us thought was resigned to the past, but actually it's still happening.
And Jay has moved away from the family. She knows she's a gay woman. She wants to live a different life in London. She's gathered like-minded people around her, but she can't share her Irish life, her family life, the story of Ferdia with these new friends. Why not?
So I think that there's quite a lot going on for her, but I think that, you know, the novel begins with this, the night that Ferdia dies, but it's also the night that Jay kisses another girl for the first time. And it's like in that moment, kind of a split opens up in her life where she just kind of leaves this past entirely behind her. She doesn't know how to process it or manage it. And so she just tries to shut it out of her life entirely. And she builds this new life for herself in London. And I think what really happens over the course of the novel is that these walls that she's very carefully built to try and keep herself safe start to crumble with this news of Ferdia's potential canonization. And she starts having to kind of ask some big questions about her grief for him, about her relationship with her parents, and ultimately kind of about the person that she wants to be.
The book is obviously a book about Ireland, because it's talking about how Ireland has changed. And you, in the book, you cleverly contrast two papal visits to Ireland, that of Pope John Paul II in 1979, and then the 2018 when Pope Francis arrived in Ireland.
Yeah, so, there's a very early scene, which is at the Pope's Mass in 1979. And then very late in the novel, there's a scene from the Pope's Mass in 2018. And I think that this speaks to something that I've always been very interested in, which is, you know, we've seen this massive period of social change in Ireland, which has been kind of typified by the collapse of the Catholic Church. But I'm interested in, beyond the headlines, what has that felt like for all of us to live through it, and I think particularly for kind of people of my generation where we grew up through this period of change, it's like how did that affect us? How did that affect our families? What does it do to a family when you have very devout parents and then children who kind of drift away? It's, you know, how did all of this feel to live through it?
Thinking of Ferdia, I know he was very young. He was very influenced by his parents. There is a scene where he's just an ordinary boy who has quite a fight with his sister. Do you think he was saintly, or do you feel that it was in some way imposed on him?
So I think this is one of the really big questions of the novel, and I don't actually have an entirely definitive answer myself. I think that there's a lot of people who have a vested interest in representing him in particular ways. But my feeling, honestly, as I was writing the novel, like I loved writing his scenes. I loved writing this character. When, you know, he appears a lot in the first section of the novel, but then almost not at all in the second section. And like I missed him when I didn't have the chance to write him anymore. And so I think that I do feel that there was something special about him. There was something kind of that stood out or that kind of shone about him. Whether that was saintliness or whether it was something else, I don't entirely know.
Now, this is your debut novel, and I know you work most of the time in other areas, and you got great support in the writing of this novel. It was recognised very early, and you got support.
Yeah, so I entered kind of an early version of the novel, so the first 10,000 words into a couple of work in progress competitions. One was called the PFD Queer Fiction Prize, and very fortunately, I won that, and I met my agent through that prize. But I also entered it in the Women's Prize Discoveries Award, which is a development program run by the Women's Prize Trust, and it was shortlisted for that. And through that, I've had lots of support from the team at the Women's Prize. I've also met an incredible cohort of writers who've been a huge support to me in the writing of this novel. And that's just, yeah, it was, you know, at that point, I was probably about halfway through the first draft, which any writers will know is kind of a bit of a dark place a lot of the time. And so getting that kind of vote of confidence from the judges in those prizes was meant a huge amount.
Well, Niamh Ní Mhaoilín, thank you very much for talking to us. The book is Ordinary Saints, and it's published by Manila Press. Julian Knox is a poet, artist and filmmaker who fled the early 1990s civil war in Sierra Leone with his family to spend a few years in Gambia before settling in London as a teenager. His films bring together choral singing, poetry and visual images to explore new perspectives on what it means to be caught between multiple histories and places. In his latest film, Chorus in Rememory of Flight, is an immersive exhibition across six galleries, and it is now at the Model Art Gallery in Sligo. The work comes from a year in which Julian travelled to nine cities across Europe, from Hamburg to Lisbon. On this odyssey, he collaborated with singers, poets, politicians, dancers and activists, and leading figures from Black communities to create a series of films that reflect on the chorus as a means of resistance. I'm delighted that Julian Knox is on the line now from France. So nice to talk to you, Julian.
Yeah, nice to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
Now, Julian, we wanted to start with a clip, which really the clip is the opening of the film. It has your poem as an introduction to the film, and then it has the site of London. Maybe you just talk us into that opening poem and clip.
So that part of the work was just me thinking about departure, and just reflecting on. Because the poem, I kind of finished the poem at the end of the film, and to just like, you know, think about what does it look like to leave the square mile of London and then going out into the world. So yeah, it's just reflecting on that. And one of the things that came up in the work was this idea of sharks changing their routes during the slave trade because there was bloodier routes for them to swim in. And it just kind of came into sort of like, light for me that the idea of like, sharks in the city, the square mile, as this idea of greed come up, the idea of like, there was a bloody route for them to swim in and sharks being this, yeah.
I absolutely get it, and we're going to come back to those themes once we hear this opening clip.
Days like these, this sun wonders how sharks change their usual routes on a planet because they realize there was a bloodier route to swim. Ask those filled with greed and no spark how long they stay the course.
You're about to leave one country. You don't know when you're going to return. You've never been there before. You sort of have an idea what it is. You don't know what difficulties you're going to encounter. I was taught when I was young that you go and say goodbye, not just to your elders there, to enable you to cross the river. So if you don't do that, you might be eaten by the crocodiles. No. The river is the beginning. The river is the transport, the river, the water, to the sea and the cross. Well, those people were forced to encounter the journey. They didn't say goodbye to their ancestors. You leave without goodbye. So it's a rupture, it's a different departure. It's a traumatic experience.
That's a clip from the opening there of Chorus in Rememory of Flight, an immersive exhibition that's currently on at the Model Art Gallery in Sligo. And Julian Knox, the artist, is talking to me on the line. Julian, that is powerful. That whole idea of sharks in the water, the cities that you chose to go around Europe to were former cities that dealt in the slave trade and really made their money and their wealth on the back of the slave trade.
Yes, exactly. So leaving the square mile and then going out into these port cities across Europe was sort of the way into them, yeah.
Yes, tell us the cities. The one about the sharks and the sharks feeding off the blood, that's Barcelona.
So that was someone that was speaking in Barcelona that mentioned that. But the idea of that for me was just in context of this, the global sort of impact of the trade and how it just shifts the whole world in terms of just Europe, America and Africa.
Yes, and I suppose that financial square mile in London distills really what you're talking about the wealth that was accumulated over time.
Yes, exactly.
Maybe you could explain what that financial square mile is in London.
In the film, it actually, someone I spoke to, his name is Patrick, and he talks a lot about that, and like, he can do a better job than I would ever. But I think for me, what was most important for me is about the stories of in the city, in these cities that I've gone to, and just sitting with them and just listening to them and seeing what stories they've got and what stories they've brought with them and how they've sort of lived their lives in these cities.
Yes, because this was your project. You first of all made contact with people in Lisbon, Hamburg, Berlin, Marseille, Antwerp, Barcelona, Rotterdam, Amsterdam and London. And you wanted to talk to activists and artists, black artists and activists. And what kind of, did you give them a brief or what was the question you asked them that you wanted them to respond to?
The sort of proposal, I guess, for them was just, I'm making this work where I'm documenting the lived experience of the Black diaspora in its city, and I would appreciate an offering from each person, and those offerings could be anything. Be a song, it could be us sitting down drinking tea, or it could be a dance, or, you know, someone was like, I'm actually tired of talking about my experience. I would only participate if you can film me sleeping. And I was like, cool, if that's your offering, and I did too. So it all came in multiple ways. The idea was like, what offering can you give towards the work to contribute to, you know, this idea of our lived experiences.
Now, chorus in Rememory of Flight. Chorus is very important, and there are wonderful choruses within the piece. Let's play a clip here where a refrain that's repeated a number of times, "We are what's left of us," is repeated. Another clip there from Chorus in Rememory of Flight, and I'm talking to the artist Julian Knox. Tell us about what choruses mean for you, and that singing, people singing together.
The idea of, I chose, you know, this form because I feel like, you know, for it to be a good chorus, you need multiple people singing in harmony. And I think the question is like, what songs are we singing across the world right now? Or what question can these songs pose at the moment? So "We Are What's Left of Us" is a line from a poem, and it's sort of asking a question and also making a statement. So I guess the statement is, you know, as it is, we are what's left of us in terms of as humans, we are the ones that are left of our histories. But then the question is, what do we do moving forward? And how can we begin to write a different history, or, you know, a better one? So I like the idea of choir coming together, because I believe there's power in music, and there's a way when we sing together, these songs would shift our bodies, would shift our mindset, and hopefully if we're all singing together, there won't be space to fight, you know?
Yes, and these are the choirs, and how you present them are very visually arresting as well. You have them costumed, and it's very, they stand out very much in the film.
Yeah, some of them are set pieces, which, you know, especially the ones in London, they wore a costume. And then in some cities, they already had their own costumes. They already had their own. So like in Marseille, the Boros Choir, they already had their own traditional way of dressing. So it was all layered. And it was just trying to find ways for me to sort of, I guess, be part of it. So asking them to sort of, you know, put in or doing some set pieces that plays across that.
And can you bring us in then to some of the artistic responses that you collected from the artists and activists that you connected with?
You know, it varies. You know, Dorothée, for example, I'm in France at the moment, so I'm just thinking about her. I met her in Marseille. And she gave me an hour of her time, and she was like, hey, you know, I want to do a dance at the edge of Marseille, looking across, you know, towards Africa. And this dance is an offering to my grandmother, who just passed. And she wanted to do that dance there. And I just sat there when we documented that moment. Other moments where a reflection. I met someone in Antwerp called Junior, and he wanted to reflect on this idea of the hands, because in Antwerp they sell these chocolate hands that you can buy brown chocolate or white chocolate. for me, it was quite, you know, triggering when I saw it because it reminded me of Congo. But in Antwerp, there's a way in which they use it as like their totem because of the myth of how Antwerp came about. Apparently, the word Antwerp means hand through in Antwerpa, which is this river that a monster sat on and would ask for a heavy toll for people to come in. And then one time this sort of champion came and killed a monster and chop off the hands and throw in the river. But then you fast forward and you think about what Leopold did to Congo mm-hmm. with all the chopped hands, it became, you know, a thing. So then he sang this song in Congolese in reflection of that. So yeah, there's like all of these sort of different moments that I can go on.
And in obviously at a different time in the 1990s, when your own country, Sierra Leone, was engulfed in that awful civil war, you left that country. What can you remember of that experience, and how do you deal with that memory, Julian?
I haven't dealt with it yet. I was a kid. I was very young when I left, and I still have memories of that.
Yes, because you would have left like while the war was going on.
Yeah, I left probably between 8 and 9 years old. I can't remember now, but yeah, I was probably like 9, 10 when I left. So yeah, it was still there, and I tend to not talk about this in interviews.
Yes.
And
at the same then with the activists and artists that you worked with in the various cities that we've mentioned, were they very open to talking about how they felt about being a black diaspora in these cities and that awful shadow of slavery that fell over these cities?
Yeah, a lot of people were open. A lot of people were also skeptical. You know, a lot of people said no, they didn't want to do it. And a lot of people said yes. And those that said yes, you know, came and like, you know, to give their offering towards it. I think for me, what it kind of boiled down to was just like, you know, what can I capture in these cities and who wanted to participate, and also how I portray the stories. There had to be sort of consideration towards that, because there are some stuff that I also kept out, and then there's stuff that I left in, and I wanted to honor, you know, some of the moments and some of the things that were said. But people were very open.
Now, this is a hugely immersive exhibition, the screens across so many galleries in the Model Art in Sligo. What do you think? What do you want people to see in the film or get from the film?
The reoccurring refrain, we are what's left of us. You know, we are what's left of our histories. And I think there's a way, you know, we can think into that now with what's happening across the world. Often we do feel like because things are not happening in our cities, we're not participating. But we all have a role to play in global history. And I think for me, this work, I want it to be a reminder of that. That we are what's left of us, and how can we begin to write new histories?
Yes, and you question the way the world is presented to us, as in north-south, rather than going south-north, for example, that we have skewed history to suit the northern hemisphere as though that has some kind of edge or importance or culture that the south does not have.
Exactly. I think that was George Shiri that mentioned that, and he was just talking about this idea of what if we think of, you know, what if, you know, the way we've been thinking, you know, we should just think otherwise, and what would the world look like if we do that? That it's not a black people versus white people, but it's actually blackness versus whiteness. And if we think about that, what does that look like? The reality of that, and the impact of that, and globally.
Well, Julian Knox, poet, artist and filmmaker, thank you so much for talking to us this evening.
No worries. Thank you very much for having me.
Julian Knox, Chorus in Rememory of Flight, is at the Model in Sligo until the 21st of June. Further details at model.ie. The dancer and choreographer Philip Connaughton's new short film, Rebellious Hope, explores what it is to spend lifetime in dance. An illustrious group of performers, including John Scott and Joanna Banks, have taken part in the film, which delves into what it is to be an older dancer. We see them dance and we hear their thoughts on what movement means to them at their age. The film has original music from the composer Mel Mercier, and it's a joint commission from the Bealtaine Festival and the Project Arts Centre. Rebellious Hope will have its premiere at the Project on Saturday the 3rd at 3 p.m. And I'm delighted to be joined here in studio by Philip Connaughton, who made the film along with collaborator Luca Truffarelli. Philip, you're so welcome.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here.
Now, the question you ask at the beginning of your film is, why am I still dancing?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and I ask myself it on a regular basis. I'm 50 this year, and I'm still dancing, and I'm still dancing fully, let's say. But it's quite a precarious career at the best of times, and it is a vocation. That sounds like a bit of a cliche, but you don't get rich, so you have to really, really love it. And there's a lot that's sacrificed to do it, but you gain a lot from it. But I suppose I wanted to make this film to help me understand how to move forward. And so I brought together a bunch of artists that I really admire and really look up to, and to help me understand that.
So you say that you have a complicated relationship with dance, and I get that it may not lead you to have a very lucrative career, because I guess work is not continuous. It may be good when you get it, but it may not be continuous.
I do very well as a dancer, but it's not only a financial thing. It's also that it has a finite timeline, and I suppose as I've said before, my body is kind of like an old secondhand car. It's very reliable, but it needs to go to the garage quite regularly to keep working. And so you're also dealing with a body that changes, and as I said before, that finite idea of when you should stop dancing. And it's very old-fashioned idea. It's very conservative idea.
And is there an idea that there is a time when you should stop dancing? And do we mean performance dancing or dancing for yourself?
Well, it's quite funny because I'm talking about professionally. I mean, I think everyone should always dance every day if they can. But last year I was working with two dancers from the Australian Ballet Company. I was in Melbourne choreographing something, and they were 29, in their late 20s, and they were talking about retiring, which was absolutely ridiculous to me, because I have no intention of retiring whatsoever. I think the body is always beautiful and always valid. And for me, as the body gets older, it has a whole history of information that it can express and that it can tell, which is fascinating.
Now, you talked about this illustrious group of dancers that you talked to, and I was very interested. You start with John Scott, mm-hmm. and you film them as they're dancing.
Yes.
So they're speaking to you. I suppose they're voicing their thoughts. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, because one of the things that's interesting for me about Rebellious Hope is that it's not a documentary about the way we danced in the past. All of these dancers, and the age ranges from 46 to 85 years old, and they're all still at the top of their game. They're all working regularly on different projects. So they're not thinking about when I danced a certain role back in the 90s or when. They're thinking, what am I doing today that can help me tomorrow. They're forward thinking, and it's exciting. It's not nostalgic at all. And so when I was recording them, I really wanted them not to talk in past tense. I wanted present and future, and I wanted them to describe their movement also, because I think that the body holds the history. I can see the history in their body.
Yes, because going back to John Scott again, he's there and he's negotiating a swivel. Yes. He's doing, and how he's going to negotiate that to, you know, while moving his hip and his leg. And, you know, it's very much in the body. Yes. He's just giving us the entree so that we can hear his thoughts. But they're not really, they're his physical movements.
They're
really,
his physical movements. Yeah. But when you break it down, it's funny, because I was doing the translations recently and just like trying to get them, because we'll be showing it in France and in Spain, hopefully. And so I'm translating. And as I was analysing it, and particularly listening to John Scott, it was fascinating how he's considering about using the arm in a certain way, and then he has to use his elbows. And, you know, there's a great thought process that's happening while you're dancing that people don't normally get to experience. So it's interesting because of that, I think.
Right, but you wouldn't be verbalising it when
you're
dancing.
No, not at all.
No.
Unless you want to.
Yes, but he's just giving us the grace of doing that for us.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Then we also, the next dancer you talk to is Fergus O'Crohour, and let's hear him. He's talking about what movement means to him, and you'll hear he's dancing as he talks.
I guess the main thing is that for me, movement comes from a place that doesn't necessarily need explanation in words. Certainly not for me, it's a space that's separate. And particularly in our culture that is so heavily word-based, holding that space open for the things that are silent and not are being articulated but not in language feels very important. And so reintroducing language, allowing it to colonize, why don't we use that word, a space that has been decolonized, because I guess that's what I've had to do, is to create or free a space in myself that has nothing to do with language. Feels intrusive.
Fergus O'Crohour there from Rebellious Hope, and I'm talking to Philip Connaughton, who made this film. Yeah, he is fighting the fight there for dance, and that it's a silent space, and there is, you know, pressure is being put on him to verbalise it, but he doesn't want that.
No, he doesn't. And I felt a little bit cruel, but I was quite excited about that because, of course, everyone has different experiences. Fergus is an amazing choreographer in his own right, but has studied at Oxford and, you know, has really gone into words in a very heavy way. So his whole dance experience is kind of, is not, I wouldn't say rejecting that, but is moving away from that, as he says, and creating a safe space where the body can just be and express as itself. That's his specific experience and opinion, which is really beautiful. But there's 7 performers and they all come with different thoughts, which is exciting.
And in a rehearsal space then, when you're creating a work, do you talk to other dancers, or would you mainly do it through your body, showing people what you want or your suggestion, and how would they respond back to you?
When I'm making work on myself, you mean? Mm-hmm. So I would do a bit of everything. I'll do whatever's useful to get where I need to get to. So, for example, I was making a piece last year and there were some moments that were specific. I really wanted to know how the audience would react. So I would find people on the street and ask them politely if they would come into the studio and watch a little bit of what I was doing. And it was a little strange, I think.
And did they come in?
Yeah, a few people came in and it was really good and they would give very honest opinions. I guess it's kind of like doing a survey. I mean, I really had to go and show them that I was a dancer and I jumped around a little bit before.
You must have been some sight. And then, Philip, when we think of dancers and aging, I suppose you think of the aches and pains, and you think of ballet dancers and their feet, for example. Mm. We see Fergus when he begins there, he's just, easing out his feet. What are the bits that go first?
Oh, the knees and the hips are the first thing to go. But yeah, I guess, but also with that, you find a way of working through it. Like when I was younger, and if I had an injury, it would be, oh, this is the end of the world. And as you get older, like that car that needs, you know, a regular upkeep, you learn how to kind of flow through and move through those things and work with them in a very kind of economical way, which is very interesting, I find.
Now, the other dancers, they're not only Irish dancers you speak to.
Yes, it's a mix of Irish and French dancers. One lady, Amy Swanson Salmon, is originally from Boston. She's Boston Irish, but she's lived in France for, I'd say 40 years now. And she is the Isadora Duncan specialist in France. So she's an incredible artist.
Yes. And then we have, of course, our own national treasure, who is Joanna Banks. Tell us a little bit about her, if people don't know already.
Okay, so Joanna Banks is iconic. She danced at the Royal Ballet, at Ballet Rambert with Marie Rambert. She's had the Bavarian State Opera, and she had a whole international, incredibly wonderful career before she came to Ireland in her 40s. And kind of like those dancers that I was talking about at the Australian Ballet, by the time she was 40, she thought she'd had her career, and she kind of thought, well, this is it, I'm moving to Dublin or I'm moving to Ireland. And she ended up, while she was here, she ended up auditioning for Irish National Ballet, and then she danced with that company for years, and then she went into contemporary dance, and she had a whole career right up until now. And Joanna's in her 80s, and she's performed in my last piece, she's performing in my next piece. She's an absolutely incredible performer.
Now, for the film, you have choreographed the pieces. So what can you tell us about the piece that has Joanna in it?
Well, so I have choreographed the works in collaboration with the other artists. So I've worked with everyone individually, and they have also improvised and given their own input. But with Joanna particularly, she works with five younger male dancers who are all absolutely wonderful and in their youthful prime, and they dance on a beach. It's Portrane Beach in December, and they're lifting Joanna, and she uses them. There's this whole exercise that I was doing with her and the dancers was that, like, they can place their hands on her and she can place her hands on them, but she decides how they move and how they react or give her pressure or release. And so it gives her a freedom of movement where she can flow and float up into the sky, and it's very impressive, and she's just wonderful.
So we also have a clip from the film with Joanna in it, and here she talks about what arms mean for a dancer, and we'll hear Mel Mercier's score for the film also.
So arms, there are so many possibilities to move them in space. They're important to feel the weight. One of my teachers said, imagine you're underwater and they need authority. And then so many memories, because there was the first endless pour de bras, very simple. Every day, the Royal Ballet School, beautiful arms. And then, if you have the privilege to dance Swan Lake, they really have to be powerful wings. You're running around the stage like mad. They really have to be strong.
Joanna Banks there from Rebellious Hope, a film by Philip Connaughton. And Philip is here with me. Yeah, that insight into the arms and the concentration when she was in the Royal Ballet she was in, and then this concentration on the arms to get them strong and beautiful, as she says.
Yes, the athleticism, I should say, that, you know, and the precision and the skill that she had to hone just to have these wings that move in a very particular way. And she has all of that now. When you see her perform, when she makes a decision, it's calculated, it's precise. and it's really captivating. And I think in the movie you can really see that. You can hear, just as you're listening to her there, you can hear the strength behind her decision making. She's a strong artist, and that's what keeps her going, and that's what gives me, she's got this rebellious hope. She's the epitome of it, you know what I mean? She's got this strength that pushes her forward into the future, and it's just so fascinating and so inspiring, not just for me as a dancer, but for everyone, because we live in such crazy ageist society where, you know, we start to think potential, there's no potential, or potential goes away or it disappears. But, you know, she's the most perfect example of somebody who gets up and goes to work and thinks, what do I have to do tomorrow to make myself a better artist? Forward thinking.
And how much training does every dancer have to do to keep yourself lithe and ready to dance? Like, is it something you have to do every day?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it depends what you want to do with your body and how you like to move. And, you know, so it's different for every different type of dancer. But yeah, I think generally you've got to keep working at your body and, you know, getting up and doing your exercises and, you know, preparing your body so that it's ready to do what you need it to do. I think when you stop doing it, it's when things begin to fall apart. So exercise.
Yes, because I was talking to Clara Kerr from Lowell yesterday, and she was saying, like, the joy in now that there's a national dance company, that people can gather together and do their exercises together or their classes together. Whereas presumably you do that on your own, unless you're working with your own company.
Yeah, when the company is together, we may warm up together, but you kind of learn to be very flexible with that, to use that word. You learn to be flexible with the sense of how you're going to warm up. I have, like, I can warm up on a postage stamp, literally, or a gigantic studio. You just learn to use what you have, you know.
Now, let's talk about the music there. I mean, when I was watching the John Scott section, it's, you know, there's this wonderful propulsive kind of music. And again, then with the Joanna, it's so evocative. How did you talk to Mel about the music that you wanted?
Well, Mel and I have been working, and Luca Trefarelli, the filmmaker, we've been working on this since early 2024, like January 2024. We were already in the studio playing with ideas, working with Joanna, for example, and Magali, one of the French artists, and just trying to get a sense of what might work. And Mel is really incredible as a composer, because he kind of comes in, I would say, at 360 degrees. He's there at the beginning, he's there in the middle, he's there at the end. He's constantly, like, shifting and changing and really taking on board the personality of each artist. And I think that comes across really beautifully in the film.
It absolutely does. Philip Connachton, thank you so much for talking to us. Philip's film, Rebellious Hope, will make its world premiere screening at the Project Arts Centre Dublin as part of Bealtaine Festival on Saturday the 3rd of May, and that's at 3 p.m. and presumably projectartscentre.ie will give you more information. Thank you so much, Philip. That's it for tonight's show. Paula Shields was the researcher. Paul Murnock was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, and tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. John Creedon is next after the news.